President Trump, on his way back from China, continues to stay on his message that the Iran war has been all about keeping nuclear weapons out of Iran's hands. They cannot have it, he said, and we're going to get that nuclear dust back, whatever it takes, whether that's willingly or unwillingly. That is the central point here. The President Trump's claim that the Iranians constantly want to have a nuclear weapon, and it was the imminent threat of one that started this war, even though he later said that all of that material is buried underneath three different mountainsides, hasn't reconciled those two disparaging things here. But he still keeps carping back on this issue. They can't have a nuclear weapon. But as Ted Postol, who we had on our show last year, told everybody that they had 400 some odd kilograms of reprocessed material that could make 10 to 12 bombs. And that would have been publicly out there until, I want to say it was January, this past January, when Steve Witkoff said they just discovered this crazy idea that they had this and that they threatened us with nuclear weapons. We have back with us Ted Postol to give an update on some of the facts that he's been telling us all along. I never was surprised about any of this stuff. And we're going to see what that tells us about where this war could go right now and what's at the heart of it. Ted, of course, welcome back. He's the, for those who, some of our new folks who may not know, professor of science and technology at the National Security at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, the MIT guru. So, Ted, first of all, welcome back to the show. We're always glad to
have
you.
Very nice to be here. Always nice to be here.
Well, listen, we like to give credit where credit is due. And I remember the first time I heard Steve Witkoff make that discovery and that this admission by the Iranian side. And I was like, dude, watch our show, man. You should have known this last year. But the rest of the world finally caught up to the information that you have. And now I want to show you this comment from President Trump here, because this is what he keeps going back to.
They think that, well, I'll get tired of this, or I'll get bored, or I'll have some pressure, but there's no pressure. There's no pressure at all. We're going to have a complete victory. Iran told me very strongly, because they intend to give us the nuclear dust, as I call it. It's easier than talking about. But you're going to have to take it out, because there's no way they have the equipment to move it. You and China are the only two countries in the world that could take it out.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm pretty sure that other countries have bulldozers, but we'll leave that aside for the moment. First of all, what do you make of this current focus on the, quote, nuclear dust that he keeps mentioning that? For just our understanding, what is he talking about?
Well, what he's talking about is a material called uranium hexafluoride. It's simply a molecule of uranium. It's a molecule with fluorine surrounding six fluorine atoms surrounding the uranium, and it has the property that if you raise it above room temperature, it looks like a salt, you know, it looks like a white salty material, crystalline material, if it's below, if it's at room temperature or below, but it quickly becomes a gas when it when the temperature is higher, it may be 50 or 60 degrees Celsius, so it's at 160 degrees Fahrenheit. And this gas can be put through centrifuges. A centrifuge is a spinning cylinder, spins at fantastic rates, like 60,000 revolutions per minute, if you're talking about the particular Iranian IR-6 centrifuge. That's 1,000 revolutions per second.
Just wow.
Just to put it. And the centrifugal forces, you know, from rotation at the wall of the rotating cylinder are about 400,000 Gs, 400,000 times the G of gravity. So the 95 to 99% of this gas is actually up against the wall because the G forces are so great. And the spinning cylinders maybe has a diameter of 20 centimeters, so 8 inches. And in the middle, it's a vacuum because the gravitational, the centripetal forces are so great that the distribution is all up against the wall. And then there are techniques for causing the gas to circulate. I should give a talk on this, actually. I have some nice, but let's not worry about that. And anyway, these centrifuges can be used to enrich this, what he calls dust, which is in the solid state, to higher and higher enrichment levels of uranium-235 relative to uranium-238. Natural uranium is about 0.7% of uranium-235, and you really want 90% or 85 or 90% uranium-235 in order to build an atomic bomb. That's what you need to put together a critical mass and get an atomic explosion.
And so you told us last year that they had enough of this at the 60% level to make 10 to 12 bombs, as you said. But there's been additional information out here recently that they have enough plutonium at 20% and other levels that they could make up to 200 nuclear bombs. This is from the Bulletin of the Atomic Science. This is not some sort of propaganda by anybody. Do you agree with this assessment?
Well, I haven't. I haven't looked at that particular issue in any great detail, but I think it's true, but it's not as well. It is of concern. I don't want to dismiss it, but the plutonium that's being talked about there is produced in a power reactor. And it's a problem because you can build bombs with that plutonium, with what's it's called reactor grade plutonium, but it really requires some pretty advanced design capabilities. The problem there is that you really want a very pure isotope of plutonium-239 to build a bomb. And when the plutonium is produced in a power reactor, it's sitting there for a long time. And as the plutonium is accumulating, other isotopes of plutonium are also accumulating because it's in a neutron field, you know, as the reactor is functioning. And so you get plutonium-239, plutonium-240, plutonium-241, 242, and all that, all those other isotopes like to disintegrate sort of randomly. And so when you construct a bomb, a plutonium bomb from this kind of material, you have to have a very, very effective implosion mechanism to get the thing compressed before it flies apart. And so this plutonium is much less problematic unless you have a very, very advanced program for building plutonium bombs.
And does Iran have the technical capacity to do that?
Well, it could have eventually, but I don't think they would have to test using that material, and they would have to do a lot of chemical.
So one of the things that has been curious to me. President Trump has focused so much on this 440 some odd kilogram of 60% reprocessed material and getting that out, and we're going to get it bad, et cetera. But according to that atomic Bulletin of the Atomic Sciences, that they're saying, look, there's a lot of others. And even if more time, even if, and this is still hypothetical, that Iran would actually give that up, that's not going to take off the table their ability to later in the future produce a bomb. Is that not accurate?
I think the knowledge is there in the population of engineers and scientists, and we're not talking about a half dozen people. We're talking about thousands of people, thousands of extremely highly trained, accomplished professionals. So this is not going to go away.
And I see.
The point that I will be making later in our discussion is that there is no hope of militarily solving this problem. It's simply not, unless you want to turn all of Iran into a radiating ruin with hundreds of or thousands of nuclear weapons and just kill everybody. Unless you want to do that, or you're willing to, which
pretty sure that's not going to happen for a number of reasons. Listen, one of the things I specifically wanted to ask you on today is one of the things that Iran has been willing to contemplate. So that's important that this is something that is in the realm of potential diplomatic outcomes, is they said, hey, how about we take this reprocessed material and over some period of time, reprocess it down until it's no longer of weapon grade anything.
Blend it down.
So can you tell us about that?
Well, the idea is very simple. You have this uranium hexafluoride, which can very quickly be put in centrifuges and be made into 90% enriched uranium hexafluoride, which can then be converted to uranium metal, which could be used to build atomic bombs. So the idea that's being proposed here is that they also have 20% enriched uranium hexafluoride. And of course, they have natural uranium hexafluoride. In other words, uranium that's 0.7% of uranium-235. So if you have the 0.7% uranium hexafluoride and you mix it in with the 60%, you can dilute it to 20%, 10%, 5%, and so forth to much lower levels of enrichment. And they have proposed that they could, they'd be willing to discuss some mechanism for blending the uranium down, the uranium hexafluoride down. And that would increase the time between them choosing to use 80% enriched uranium for bombs. It would increase the lead time between them making a decision to go ahead and produce a bomb and relative to what they have with the 60%. So what they're basically offering to do is to do something to mechanically, verifiably increase the time it would take them to produce atomic weapons from the materials they have, rather than now they can do it, it's hard to know in detail, but, they could potentially do it in weeks of time with, exactly how short a time depends on how fully set up they are. But if they're fully set up, they could produce an atomic bomb every few weeks from this material, maybe even more quickly than that if they have everything in place. But it's impossible to believe they don't have the centrifuges to do this.
And I wonder if you could talk, because the claim is from the administration that there were three sites where this was going on and they were all obliterated in Operation Midnight Hammer in 2025. And so all of this, what Trump keeps calling the nuclear dust, it's this 60% reprocessed material, is apparently split between three different places and they need U.S. and China to come get it, et cetera. So they can't get it out there. But as I recall from one of our previous conversations, and tell me if this is accurate, is that the Iranians have the ability to make new centrifuges, not just the ones that are allegedly buried under these mountains, and things should be going on that we don't even know about. Is that accurate?
Well, yeah. I mean, in the 3 or 4 months before Midnight Hammer, the Iranians were producing 440 centrifuges per month. 440 of them. Now, to build what's called a cascade, the standard cascade that the Iranians have been playing with, they need 174 centrifuges. So that's an arrangement of centrifuges. Let's not worry about those details. But so they were building easily two and a half cascades of centrifuges per month. Now, they had not necessarily assembled into those centrifuges into cascades and tuned them, which is a big operation, but they clearly had tremendous manufacturing capability. Now, we don't know how many of these centrifuges are lying around, because we lost the ability to monitor the production facilities, because when we arbitrarily, and I will say arbitrarily, Mr. Trump arbitrarily withdrew from the what's called the JCPOA, which is the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. This was an agreement we had reached in 2015, which eliminated any possibility of the Iranians building nuclear weapons and had very, very stringent oversight conditions attached to it. So this was really a good deal. He just claimed without any evidence. I mean, it's just ridiculous that this was not a good agreement, typical no analysis decision, like going to war without having thought about it. And he removed this important constraint. And the Iranians did not respond in a negative way immediately. They tried to, hold on to this situation for a little while. Typically, this is the way the United States has ruined all kinds of treaty agreements we've been in over the years. And we can go through a lot of them. You've already done this. And, you know, when you're talking about Ukraine or whatever, Minsk II, you know, just go on and on. The Biden administration then dropped the ball. Let's not let Mr. Biden and Anthony Blinken and,
for sure,
get off free here. What these guys did is they, rather than immediately reinstate the JCPOA, they typically, like the Democrat, I'm hoping there'll be a new Democratic Party if they retake the Congress. But if we have the old Democratic Party, we're in big trouble. The whole country's in big trouble. We need a Democratic Party that has some real political leadership. But the real problem was that Biden didn't immediately reinstate the JCPOA. They start screwing around with the Iranians. They say, oh, you got to stop building ballistic missiles, things like that. Look, you have a treaty, stay with the treaty. If you're worried about the ballistic missiles, start a new negotiation. Now, this is typical of the American dysfunction, and it is an American dysfunction, and it's serious. And so the Iranians just say, well, we had an agreement. Why don't you meet the terms of the agreement? You're the ones who withdrew. And Biden is there screwing around with them, trying to make additional demands like they're the ones who withdrew. And this is exactly the kind of terrible diplomacy, both done by Republicans and Democrats, that we have seen that has put the country in jeopardy. And I mean,
it really does. And I want to go because for the benefit of our viewers here, you put together a slide deck for us that kind of shows us some of the issues about the reprocessing. Can you get into some of that and kind of help us in a layman's term understand what's really going on?
Well, let me just give you a few of the main points. I won't. There are these word slides that are available if people want them. So I won't go through them in terrible detail. There's basically about 440 kilograms of 60% uranium hexafluoride, which is capable of not producing simply 10 bombs, but 10 to 20 bombs. And I'll explain why that's the case. So I'm revising my earlier statement from 10 bombs to 10 to 20. And anybody who doesn't think thinks there's no difference between 10 and 20 atomic bombs really needs to sit down and have a further talk from me. And the reason that I've revised this estimate is because you can build the 10 bomb estimate is based on the idea that you would build an atomic bomb with 25 kilograms of highly enriched uranium. This is a standard that was established by the Non-Proliferation Treaty, but it's not, it's okay for purposes of bureaucratic assessment, but it's not accurate if you want to assess what a country like Iran could do, because What Iran could do is build bombs with uranium-238 tampers. In other words, you have the core, which is enriched uranium, and you surround the core with a hollow sphere of uranium-238. And that acts in two important ways. First of all, it reflects neutrons back into the uranium core when it goes critical. And that means you need less, when you have no reflector, when the neutrons escape from the surface of the uranium core, you need 55 kilograms of uranium to get a nuclear yield. But I can go down to 14 kilograms if I reflect neutrons back in. And the way to do that is with uranium-238. Now, keep in mind that uranium-238 is a very massive material. So it not only reflects neutrons back into the core, resulting in a smaller amount of uranium-235 being needed, 14 or 15 kilograms rather than 25 or 55 kilograms, but it also has a tremendous amount of mass, which tends to retard the disassembly of the uranium core when it goes supercritical. And you only need to, you know, delay by a few hundredths of millions of seconds the disassembly to get a much higher yield, because you have this runaway nuclear explosion going on. So you not only need a smaller amount of uranium, but you can get a bigger yield because the massive reflector or tamper keeps the thing from disassembling so quickly. So you get the benefits, two benefits from this tamper. Well, if you can only need 14 or 15 kilograms of uranium metal, then you can build 19 or 18 to 20 bombs from this 440 kilograms, not just 10. So that's an insight.
And again, Ted, let me just ask here. So that's of the current stockpile of whatever 400 some odd kilograms. But if they start going down this path, one would imagine, and correct me if you think I'm wrong, is that some of this other plutonium that they have, they would concurrently start also reprocessing that and get it up to this kind of level. So that would be like an entry level 18 to 20 bombs potentially, if they make this decision.
That's with uranium.
Is that right?
Not plutonium, uranium. You see, uranium has a special property that when it doesn't spontaneously disintegrate the atomic at the nuclear level. So when I'm putting this thing together into a critical mass, there's no danger that neutrons will be introduced prematurely and cause this thing to pop apart. Plutonium has all kinds of random neutrons produced while you're trying to assemble this, which is why you need this much more complex spherical implosion technique. So the plutonium is not such an immediate threat. It may be a longer term threat if the Iranians choose to use plutonium to make nuclear weapons. But they don't need to do that. So the plutonium problem is real, but it's in my view overstated, because what people, you know, best is the enemy of good enough. And good enough is the uranium they already have in hand. And if you can build 20 bombs, what do you need more for?
Yeah.
I mean, 20 bombs is plenty. So and not only that, they can produce with the centrifuges they currently have, they could produce a couple of bombs per year from natural uranium. So if they're left alone and they are forced, let me underscore how I say this, they are forced by the Americans to go and make a decision to build atomic bombs. They don't want to do this. Let's be clear. The Iranians understand that if they start building nuclear weapons, they will reduce their overall security. That's why they have not gone the extra distance from 60%.
Can you explain that? Because it seems counterintuitive. If they get nuclear bombs, they decrease their security. Why do you say that?
Well, they have Saudi Arabia sitting across the Persian Gulf. Saudi Arabia has made it very clear multiple times that if Iran has nuclear weapons, Saudi Arabia will also get nuclear weapons. And what's generally not appreciated is Saudi Arabia has an understanding with Pakistan. The Saudis funded Pakistan's nuclear program. The Pakistanis did not have the economic resources to go ahead and build this tremendous uranium enrichment capability that they have. And there was an informal agreement reached between Saudi Arabia and Pakistan that if Saudi Arabia needed to build nuclear weapons, that Saudi Arabia would give them nuclear weapons if and when that situation came about. So Saudi Arabia would not have to start from scratch to get nuclear weapons. They would very quickly be able to get nuclear weapons by pre-arrangement from Pakistan. So the Iranians are fully aware of this situation. They understand, they're not stupid, and they understand that what they need to do is to not create a situation where the Saudis are going to go to the Pakistanis and say, we now need those weapons. We now have this threat that we were hoping we would not see. So, and the Iranians have been very explicit about this. I mean, they have made public, the public discussions of this. If you listen to Mohammad Zarif, who negotiated the JCPOA with the Americans, he talks about this. This is a man with a very erudite understanding of international security and the nuclear weapons technology. He knows both. He's a trained scientist and engineer. He's a very, very accomplished, intellectually accomplished individual. And he has made it clear. He said, and he's talked to people. I mean, I just talked to a friend of mine who was talking to, who had discussions directly with Zarif while he was visiting in 2015, while he was visiting Iran during the negotiations. And Zarif very eloquently described to him why Iran does not want nuclear weapons, but why they feel they need the option to produce nuclear weapons if they reach a point where the threat, where they have no choice. So their choice is to not build nuclear weapons. They do not want, they are not going to attack Israel because they understand that Israel has a large number of nuclear weapons and an attack on Israel would be national suicide. They understand that. They are rational. They are more rational than their American and Israeli counterparts. They understand these things. They understand that if they have nuclear weapons, they will wind up with a nuclear-armed Saudi Arabia. They will also wind up, probably in a somewhat later time interval, with a nuclear-armed Turkey, potentially nuclear-armed Persian Gulf states, and a potentially nuclear-armed Egypt, which is more than capable of building its own atomic bombs. So they know that they will be kindling a bonfire, an explosion of nuclear proliferation around them, states immediately near them. So they are rational. They want to negotiate. So you have a potential adversary who wants to negotiate, who is sensible. They understand what's in their own best interest. And all you have to do is negotiate with them. And I don't understand.
But your argument is if we don't we push them into a corner, even with that diminished security, they would rather have that than no security. Is that your position?
If we leave them no choice, at some point in, every country is has a complex domestic political infrastructure. And we know that there are people inside Iran who think it's a good idea to have nuclear weapons now as quickly as possible. I think they're wrong. I think Zarif thinks they're wrong. I think Abbas Araghchi, the current prime minister, also thinks they're
foreign
wrong.
Foreign minister,
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And he's rational too and very well informed. So let's negotiate. If you push the Iranians into a posture where the people like Araghchi and Zarif cannot prevail in the internal domestic debate, and they proceed to build nuclear weapons, we're all going to be in a much less secure situation. Iran,
indeed,
the Israel, Saudi Arabia, everybody is going to be in a much less secure situation.
And therefore,
so why wouldn't you not negotiate?
Well, and that's because that's the logical and the rational thing, which is very short order. There's a dearth of that in senior administration and elite
Absolutely.
Western thinking, not even just the administration.
The Western mindset.
The Western
political situation is totally out of control.
It is.
It's just amateurs at every level.
Yeah, and that's what makes the next part here challenging, too, because right now, President Trump is, I think he's either on his way back or is now back in the United States from his visit to China. So now all the focus, which had been on Beijing and business deals, now returns back to here. And he was asked on Air Force One last night a bunch of questions about the Iranian situation. And now he is once again coming under the microscope that people are saying, are you going to have some kind of a negotiated deal? Are you going to just walk away? Or are you going to go back to the military front? Now, President Trump still keeps talking pretty militaristic about going back and either a love tap, as he calls it, or go back and finish the job, as some other people do. But in terms of even discussing whether he should or not, what that might accomplish, there's a couple of things that I'd like your view on that I know you're some expert on that I'd like your answer here. And number one is that there's this claim that over 90% of Iranian missiles have been intercepted, but there is a critical vulnerability that's growing, the report warns. This is something that came from the Pentagon. But the problem is that they're saying that, you know, even the 10% getting through was, we saw the physical results of it with the, you know, all these targets getting hit in Saudi Arabia, Qatar, UAE, especially Israel, our bases, et cetera. But do you believe that 90% number?
I think it's ridiculous. It's totally ridiculous. In fact, I generally have been saying 5%, but what I've really been saying is no more than 5% intercept rate against the ballistic missiles. And let me tell you, I think it's very likely below 5%. It's probably 2 or 3%.
And what do you base that off of?
I base it off real data. This is not pie in the sky, you know. Oh, I thought about it, rubbed my stomach, looked at the sky, and came up with this number. You know, I what I should do, I'll be in Germany next week. We might I don't know if we can schedule something from Berlin, but I have put together a video of, you know, that demonstrate that shows what you can see. The video is designed to explain what is happening, and I've just been increasing my skills with handling videos. I'm becoming a video expert, and so I can stop, you know, so I take the video, you know, events occur and I can stop the video and then show you in slow motion what's happening and discuss that. And what I can show you is that in massed raids, where I have a video showing several massed raids, there are almost no intercepts. There are the useful thing about the massed raid is there are intercepts. So you can see an intercept. And because you can see the massed raid, you can see that there are no other intercepts. So I lay that out for you. So it's very clear in these videos, absolutely transparent. And, you know, let the Pentagon come up with their own video based on the data. It's all out there in the public domain. So I can, you know, I'll put the videos out there. I'll send the videos to anybody who wants to replicate them. And, you know, let the, you know, let some public figures, you know, some people who are amateurs who know how to work with videos do what I've done. You know, I'd be happy to encourage people to do that. If they want, you know, if they come up with videos and, you know, come up with a good set of videos that they want to analyze, I'll work with them so that they, you know, the only agreement I want from them is that you allow me, I give you credit for it because it's not my video, but you allow me to show the videos and in subsequent things. But if there are people out there who want to do this, I'm pleased to work with you. And but I'll show you a basic video that can be replicated by people who know how to work with videos. Probably do a better job than me.
Let's by all means get that on the schedule. You can make it work next week. Let's definitely work with you.
But I'll be in Berlin, so you know there's a time difference, and we can see it.
No worries. Yeah, we'll always.
Let me tell you, there's no 90% intercept rate there, and they're asking for billions of dollars for new Patriot interceptors that cannot do the job. So that's another thing. In one of the you'll have to, I can only keep up with the news, but I found one little article that says they want 1,200 new Patriot PAC-3 interceptors. That's ridiculous. 1,200 new interceptors might intercept a few ballistic missiles, a few. And you'd spend, $3 or $4 billion on them. That's not exactly a good choice, for intercepting a few tens or of Iranian ballistic missiles.
Well, now let me look at that. That's in defensive intercepts. Now let's look.
So this is a big issue.
Yeah, of course, it's a huge issue. Not just for this war, but for any others that we might
absolutely
into. But now I want to look at the offensive capabilities, whether it's JASSM, Tomahawk cruise missiles, ATACMS, anything you want to imagine. And that is on what we can do. There was a claim that the Iranian side still had 70 some odd percent. That was in the New York Times, CNN, several other outlets that said their analysis had showed that despite what we claim, that we had only taken out about 25-30% of the Iranian missile capability. But then in Senate testimony here, Admiral Cooper says, no, actually, that's not true. We've knocked out 90% of Iran's defensive industry, completely destroyed. And I know that we've had you talk on here about, you know, some of these missile cities, they call them, where they're inside the mountains. We've attacked this particular one. Yes, I know specifically was attacked 7 times as of late March. I hadn't seen the number since that time. One other we saw was hit 22 times, and they're able to pull it get it back into operational capacity pretty quick because the missiles can't get through. What do you make of this claim?
Well, I think that diagram that diagram that was just shown is a very good summary of the situation. So let's just look at this for a second. Now, of course, if this were a real if this were to scale, if this diagram were to scale, the tunnels would be tiny in size relative to the mountain that's shown there. So that alone would indicate that the cross-sectional area that is potentially collapsible is tiny, because the tunnels only fill a tiny volume in that mountain. So when those bombs that are put on the top of the cartoon are coming in, there's almost nowhere they could hit that it would likely be above a tunnel. So the chances of doing any real so I don't know where this general, this admiral, gets his information. Is he saying that that he has information that this is true? He has no data. He cannot possibly have data from our intelligence sources to show that this is the case. He's just blowing it out of his ass. I mean, this is quite frankly, I think Admiral Cooper should be called on the carpet and asked to provide the information, provide evidence for the information he's claiming to have. Because I don't see that he can have it at all. And this kind of lying, and I mean lying by a soldier who is working for the country, is unacceptable. If a political figure wants to lie about it, that's unfortunate, but as far as I'm concerned, if there were a new administration that came in that was not, you know, I would have Cooper out the door along with everybody else who lied this way among our military. Those are the people I want fired. I don't want those soldiers who stood up and said, no, sir, I can't lie about this. My job is to defend the country. If you want me to follow your orders, I will do it. But that doesn't include lying to the Congress and the American people. Find somebody else.
And Ted, even if we didn't have your expertise analysis here that we've had and we're going to have, God willing, next week, if we had 90% of their capability knocked out, then number one, we would never have gone to a ceasefire. We would have finished that 10%. The war would have been over. The strait would have been open, et cetera. And the fact that none of that stuff happened, that the strait is still closed, even without data, shows how absurd the claim is. And yet there it is. We can't dispute it. There it is right on the screen.
What happened that led to this lying campaign by a soldier, I'm sorry to sound irritating, by a soldier who should know better. I'm really, it pisses me off, I must say. But what resulted in this lying from a soldier who should know better is a leak that was published in the Washington Post of a supposed CIA assessment that concluded that the Iranians have 75% of their firepower still in place. Now, Araghchi was then quoted later, shortly thereafter, saying the CIA report was wrong. He said that they have 120% of what they had before the attack. Now, I have no idea whether Araghchi is correct. And also, I doubt the CIA report is anything more than an informed guess. But an informed guess is still, 75% would not surprise me. 90% still in place would not surprise me. And 120% in place, we don't know. The bottom line is we don't know and we cannot know. So these claims, 75% estimate based on, just looking at the technology available to us and the technology already implemented by the Iranians, a 75% guesstimate is quite plausible to me. It's not unlike my guesstimate, but it's a guess based on what we know. And we know these facilities are extremely robust.
Right, We know, like the Yazd facility there that was pictured, and one of these others. And unfortunately, I couldn't find the data that I had cited yesterday. Yeah. It had been hit 22 times and is still operational. And that's one of 33 that are along the Persian Gulf side in the Gulf of Oman, just that forward facing. That doesn't even count the other.
God knows where
dozens that are further back. Yeah, so the overall percentage probably is much less than that in terms of their total capability. But as you say, it's a state secret, and we have no way of knowing what those exact numbers are or what's inside each of those. But tell me if you agree or not, because my assessment is that based on all the stuff that you've talked about today, their technical capacity, the physical amount of processed material that they have at various locations, the near inability or impossibility, if one may even say so, to knock out all of these underground missile cities, and the residual capacity of the Iranian government makes any return to military just, if not suicidal, certainly really counterproductive, because that could push the Iranian side into saying, all right, we have no choice now. We have to have a bomb process, or we'll just empty the rest of our long-range missiles and burn through a number of our other interceptor missiles, then having almost nothing left, that we still won't compel them to do anything that we want, and it will be a loss of unimaginable magnitude. I mean, how do you see it?
Well, this an attack would reignite what I call the numbskull social effect. You have numbskulls in the U.S. government, and you have numbskulls in Iran. And the numbskulls in the U.S. want to solve this problem with a tool that has no chance of working. So they're blocking a solution. And the numbskulls in Iran want to proceed and build nuclear weapons in spite of the fact it's not in the national security interest of Iran. And so our numbskulls feed the numbskulls in Iran. And if we attack Iran in a serious way again, it will arm the numbskulls in Iran because they have voices within the domestic debate within Iran. And sooner or later, people like Zarif and Iraqi are going to lose. And if they lose that debate, everybody loses. I want to be clear, everybody loses. Not only the Iranians, but the Saudis lose, the Persian Gulf states lose, the Israelis lose, the United States loses. We have a big burst of proliferation on our hands, of nuclear proliferation, resulting in all the states involved having a reduced national security. That's the outcome. So I call it the numbskull effect. Yeah. And if the numbskulls in the U.S. make it possible for the numbskulls in Iran to win, that's what we're going to be looking at.
That's the best analogy I've ever heard. So I appreciate that. And we appreciate all the stuff that you do. And we are eager to look forward to seeing what you're going to do next week, if your schedule can be worked out, or the following
week,
if not.
Or the following week, so I'm back in the States. Yes.
Yeah, one way or the other, we'll get that, because I think, yeah, I
agree. Lying has to stop.
Yep.
And one way for it to at least be mitigated, I'm sorry to sound so tough on this, but I know you agree, actually, is our officers should not be lying to the Congress and the public. It's just unacceptable. Anybody who has lied to the public about these important matters when they're in a position as a soldier should no longer be a soldier when a new administration comes in. That's my feeling. And every soldier who's been fired because he refused to lie should be brought back in, and an apology should be given to them. That's what I would want to see done. And I hope we have a new president who's not like Biden, who corrects this absolutely outrageous situation of abusing the best of our military officers who have integrity. I really feel deeply, deeply angry about this.
I can see that. And that is what genuine America First patriotism would look like.
And I guess integrity. I'm a MAGA person from that perspective.
Well, that's distinct. MAGA is distinct from a genuine America First patriot. Yes. Let me just be clear on that. Okay. So. You're the kind that we need more of. So thank you very much.
We should treat our military a hell of a lot. The best in our military is really great. We really have good people.
We really do.
We need to get rid of these clowns and bring in and really empower the good people we have. And we have a lot of them. And I want to see that occur.
Very good. Thank you very much. And we will look forward to seeing you very soon. And we will see you guys this afternoon at, I think, 2:30 p.m. I'm going to give you an update on where we are diplomatically and militarily about what may or may not be coming next in the Iran war and the implications for both. See you then at 2:30 on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive. You know, we don't have sponsors because we hate to hit you over the head with ads. I don't like them. So show a little love back. Subscribe, like, and send this to somebody you care about.